Ising's solution of his model in one dimension. And we noticed that the model could be written as the hyperbolic cosine of k raised to the power n times 2 to the n times the product from j equals 1 up to n of 1 plus the hyperbolic tangent of k times sigma j plus 1. And as was pointed out to me, what you can think of doing here is averaging this over all of the spins, assuming that those spins are uncorrelated and they take on the value plus or minus 1. When we do this, as we went through it last time, there are two terms. Either you get 1, all n terms are 1, or you get all n terms of the hyperbolic tangent. In the first case, of course, the average of 1 is 1. In the second case, what happens is that you have each one of these sigmas repeated twice, and you make use of the fact that sigma j squared is equal to 1, so that the average gives you, in fact, the hyperbolic tangent raised to the nth power. All of the other terms in the product fall away and don't count for anything. This same kind of approach can be used to calculate the correlation function, which describes what happens when you have a spin at k and another one at k plus n. This also can be written as the same sort of thing, twice the hyperbolic cosine of k raised to the nth power, factors 1 plus sigma 1, sigma 2, hyperbolic tangent of k. Factors like this keep on going until we get to here we have at a sigma k on one side, 1 plus the hyperbolic tangent of sigma k minus 1 times sigma k. And on the other side, 1 plus the hyperbolic tangent of k times sigma k plus 1. And then we keep on going until we get to sigma k plus n. And on this side, there's 1 plus sigma k plus n, sigma k plus n plus 1, and the usual hyperbolic tangent. And at this side of 1, plus the usual hyperbolic tangent times sigma k plus n minus 1 times sigma k plus n. Yes, please. Thank you. It is what I said it was, but that's okay. It is defined to be the average of the product of the two spins at neighboring sites. But that's a trivial statement. What it tells you is if I've got a spin here and another one over there, are they pointing in the same direction or in opposite directions? If they're pointing in the same direction, you get a contribution plus 1. If they're pointing in opposite directions, you get a contribution minus 1. The correlation function then tells you how much more likely it is for them to be lined up than for them not to be anti-aligned. Whom am I answering, please? Put your hand up. Thank you. Than for them to be anti-aligned. So we're talking about how much lining up there is in the situation. We expect if there's strong coupling with spins near each other, will tend to be very lined up with one another, where spins far away from one another will tend to have very weak correlations. Therefore, we expect that this quantity to be close to one if these guys are close to one another, and to be very small when they're far apart. In fact, at the end of the last hour, I said that this average will turn out to be the hyperbolic tangent of k raised to the nth power, small n. That says if these guys are separated by n steps, you get a number here which is smaller than unity raised to the nth power. As n gets larger and larger, this product or this power gets smaller and smaller. If n goes to 0, this guy goes to 1. But now I'm going to do the calculation, or at least wave my hands around at the calculation, which enables you to find this out. That calculation is to take the average over uncorrelated spins of this product, which I wrote down at over covering so much blackboard. There are two kinds of terms you can get. Either you get ones multiplying ones, or you get tangents multiplying tangents. That's because you must have an even number of terms, even number of terms in the product of four spins of each kind. The pattern is broken, of course, by putting these two spins in. If I start out with ones here, I get a one in this term, a one in the next term, a one in the next term, then this sigma k breaks that pattern and generates a term which is has a non-zero average by multiplying there. So I go along with ones until I get to this point. I then get hyperbolic tangents. The hyperbolic tangents continue until I get to this point, whereupon I return to ones. That's one of the two terms in this summation. The other term says that we have hyperbolic tangents going along until we hit this guy, and then we get ones, and then we get hyperbolic tangents again. However, I am assuming that n, that k plus n and k are both much less than the number of particles in the system. And that means that the term, that the first term I talked about, the one in which we have mostly ones, wins. That means that the answer for this correlation function is this. And that says, I'll write it out again, that sigma j times sigma k times sigma k plus n is a power. It falls off exponentially. It goes as e to the minus n times something. What's that something? Well, if I say that nA is a physical distance, x, between these two points, a being a lattice constant or a distance between nearest neighbors, then I can write this as e to the minus x, nA, divided by some physical length, and I can then calculate the physical length based on the fact that the correlation function is this. This physical length tells us the decay constant, the rate at which the correlation function falls off. And this length is first of all proportional to A. Trivial algebra, but I am entirely capable of getting it wrong. So let me write it down here. The length is A divided by the logarithm of the hyperbolic tangent of K one over the hyperbolic tangent of K. First, let's see that this makes sense. One over the hyperbolic tangent of K is a number between one and infinity, since the hyperbolic tangent is a number between zero and one. The logarithm of a number bigger than one is a positive number. This gives this length as a positive number. As K goes to infinity, the hyperbolic tangent approaches unity. As the hyperbolic tangent approaches unity, the logarithm approaches zero, and this thing gets very large. So this goes to infinity as K goes to infinity. That means that as we have, if we have strong coupling, the spins line up very well, and you have to go for a very, very long distance before they lose their correlations with one another. In the opposite limit, in which K goes to zero, this hyperbolic tangent is a very small number. The inverse is a very large number. The logarithm of a large number is a large number. A constant over a large number is a small number, and so that this this correlation length, this range of correlations, goes to zero as K goes to zero. Now, one of the things that physicists learn to do is to go do things that are better than this, to say how with the it goes to infinity, how it goes to zero. I will do that in a moment, but the physics of this is then brought out by this gentleman's question, namely the physics is how things in one portion of space connect with things in another portion of space. In fact, of course, your whole training in physics is about how things relate in one part of the world to another, how correlations, how information is carried from one place to another. But let's talk about the limiting cases. Yes, please. Thank you. The correlation function, let me write it out for you in a different way. The average of anything is the sum over all of the variables you might think of, e to the minus beta h, times those things, normalized with a z. Okay, you recognize that? Move the z over to the other side of the equation. Here it is. Z times that average is this summation or this average. Thank you. I'm sorry, I didn't understand the words. So say them again for me, please.
The product of Z and the correlation function tangent, is it positive K to the end, or is it only the correlation function?
The exact and correct answer is that this correlation, this thing, is the hyperbolic tangent of K raised to the nth power. That's the answer. Period. We can check it by one case, which is obvious, if n equals 0, this thing is 1, and the average of 1 is 1, and the average of anything raised to the 0th power is 1. That's one obvious place for checking. We're going to see other ways of checking in a little bit. Okay? Thank you for sharpening the result. I made no new assumptions. The basic idea, the basic stuff, is that to calculate the average of anything, we take the sum over everything of e to the minus beta times the Hamiltonian divided by the partition function. That partition function is put in there in order to make the normalization of this be right. And then we multiply by, if this thing is A, we multiply by A here. That's what's been done there. In a just in a long-winded way in which every term in this product was written out in disgusting detail. Okay, let me repeat what my suggestion. You all are having difficulties with my presentation. However, if you do the calculation for n equals 2 or 3, it will become obvious to you. And it's worth carrying it out. I'm back here, yes? Where did I get this from, or where did I... Let me derive this. If we have... Well, first we have this is e to the k minus e to the minus k over e to the k plus e to the minus k. I want to first of all talk about the limit in which k is large. That's the interesting and not so easy limit. I'll multiply through on the numerator and the denominator by e to the minus k. This is identical to 1 minus e to the minus 2k over 1 plus e to the minus 2k. Nothing has happened so far. I will then say that e to the minus 2k is small because k is large. I will then expand. I get, first of all, a term like 1. And secondly, I get twice e to the minus 2k from 1 from here and 1 from there. Plus dot, 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 and dot, 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 dot means e to the minus 4k, e to the minus 6k, e to the minus 8k. Then I have to look back at that expression for the correlation length. The correlation length is a over logarithm of the hyperbolic tangent raised to the minus 1 power. Here I have the hyperbolic tangent raised to the first power. However, in the limit in which this is small, the hyperbolic tangent to the minus 1 power is equal to 1 plus twice e to the minus 2k. Hyperbolic tangent is just smaller than 1. 1 over the hyperbolic tangent is just larger than 1. So I take this and replace this by 1 plus twice e to the minus 2k. And then use the fact that the logarithm of 1 plus something small is that small thing. And end up with a statement that the correlation length is, except for a factor of the separation between two nearest neighbors, and a factor of 2, e to the twice k. As k gets large, this gets exponentially large. And that's all sort of hidden in here. I'm sorry, my ears aren't the best in the world. So I understood the question was about the correlation function. I talked my way across this blackboard and then came up with this result. Once you accept this result, this is a form of exponential. It is something raised to a power. That's an exponential. It is the form of e to the minus na, which is a physical distance, divided by c, which is another physical distance, just defined by this expression. So going from here, looking at this gave this. Writing this result for the correlation function, here it is, sigma k plus n, is this thing, is e to the minus na over c, then it gives me a way of calculating c, and in fact gives c is a divided by the logarithm of the hyperbolic tangent of k to the minus first power. Aside from going from here to there, everything else happens slowly, right in front of your eyes. Now, I'm going to ask the question, why do we get an e to the minus 2k in dealing with stuff here? Let's see. Up. Middle one comes down. The e to the minus 2k, the limit of large k, is not an accident. It comes about because this is a system of spins, and we can get what are called defects. At low temperatures, we tend to line up all the spins like this. But sometimes one spin is out of line. That's one kind of defect. Another kind of defect is if you have the spins going along and coming up, and then you get the whole bunch of spins from there on going down. So let's put dot, dot, dots. These are two kinds of defects. Either one of these defects will mess up the correlation between here and here. This kind of defect will mess up the correlation between here and there. Now, what is the cost? The cost of doing this is how much of e to the minus beta h you lose by changing from everything up to one spin down, or everything up to a whole bunch of spins down. This point defect costs e to the minus 4k. How do I know that? Well, I've lost this bond and I've lost that one. They've gone the wrong way. This was originally an e to the k. When it went the wrong way, it became e to the minus k. That's a net loss of e to the minus 2k. That happens also here, and one ends up with an e to the minus 4k. On the other hand, this kind of thing is less costly. This is called the Bloch wall and goes under the fancy name of a topological defect. Only one bond here is unsatisfied. Only one place that there isn't an e to the k correlation energy. If it's one bond and we change it from plus to minus, which we lose a factor of e to the minus 2k. So the Bloch wall is the more likely defect. This for large k is much less likely. The Bloch wall is what it is, what we see producing the loss of correlation in the system. That's the why we have an e to the 2k in this correlation length. Why we have this factor of 2 has sort of escaped me, but that's since I've got the leading dependence, I'm reasonably happy, and I'm a little unhappy that I lost the factor of 2 someplace. Let me show it to you more or less on the computer. One of the things that we have in this age of computers is the possibility of seeing, at least in classical problems, seeing what is going on. Condensed matter physicists, and I'm an example of that breed, don't think that it is terribly easy to understand what is going on unless you can see it in several ways. Maybe theory, like that e to the minus, e to the 2k over here. Maybe a hand wave. Thank you. That's what I wanted to do. I would have pushed the button next. In the Greek theater, ancient Greece, the gods would come on stage towards the end of the play and make everything right. We have offstage gods here who make everything right. Now, I have to remember how to push buttons. I lost buttons. Where am I? I've lost the buttons I'm supposed to push. Excuse me? Under the paper. Yep, thank you. I hit HDMI. I take the lights low, and I think everything is fine. I then go back to the computer, and okay. What do I have here? Well, I have a one-dimensional Ising model. Back here on this sheet of paper, I have a Monte Carlo simulation of a one-dimensional Ising model. This has k, the coupling, equal to 1.5, and e to the 2k, which is the crucial thing, as we see from here, at strong values of k, has the value 20. There are 20 spins lined up there. And if I click my little arrow on the right place, the system will show some time development. Here, all the green Everything being green means that all of the spins are pointing down. That gives us a magnetization of minus 20 and shows that this is what's happening. It started out probably someplace over here, and in time I wasn't looking at it, wandered off to this point. Now we're going to look and see what happens. I'm going to click on the thing again, and it's going to go through a bunch of steps of the computer calculation. Let me bring down this thing, which provides a record of what we're going to, of what's happening. And with a little bit of luck, what's going on here? Okay, this is a, mysterious things happen. But here's the second interval of time. We've gone through a thousand steps, and we're still all lined up. I'm hoping something interesting happens, but this thing isn't set up. So there. Now we got it. There's a block wall extended for here and a block wall there. And the system has two different regions. In the two different regions, the magnetizations point in opposite directions. This is the likely kind of defect in this one-dimensional system. The system can go from here, which to either to all red or to all green, and is likely to do so. That is, this kind of system is likely to have its magnetization all lined up as here, this minus 20 magnetization, or here, the plus 20. We'll see what happens in the next bunch of steps. I don't know what's going to happen, because this is all determined by a random number generator. Okay, it turned out to have its behavior about here. That's what we're seeing there. It is mostly red, and that's the red side, but there's a little bit of green. Now we have had a bunch of intervals in which we have lined up the magnetization on the red side, and that's this over here. And we've gone through 3,000 steps, Monte Carlo steps, and seen much of what we want to see for this kind of system. I'm just going to finish it out. The computer is set to do 4,000 steps. Again, we have a small region of magnetization, which is pointing in the opposite direction, and two block walls. And the calculation finishes up with those two block walls. This is magnetization about over here. That's what happens to the one-dimensional Ising model. You see as in front of your eyes, so to speak, both this kind of thing and also the behavior of e to the 2k. Please ask the question.
They are periodic.
This gentleman is pointing out to me that if we have periodic boundary conditions, so that this guy is the same as this guy, then it is impossible for me to have one defect. I've got to have two. So this guy will be red, and these guys will be green. Or I could have four, or six, or eight, but an even number of defects, as this gentleman is pointing out. And in fact, that's what we've seen on the screen. If we had anti-periodic boundary conditions, the story would be different, but I'm waiting for you to tell me about it because it's on the homework. I said last time what periodic and anti-periodic meant, but let me say it again. Periodic means sigma j plus n is sigma j. That's periodic. Anti-periodic, sigma j plus n is equal to minus sigma j. That's anti-periodic. And this works for all j. let's see where I am. Oh, okay, fine. We're now going to look at the same problem in an entirely different way, unless you all want to. I have so much fun with this. I'm going to run it once more, just for the plain old fun of it. It's such a wonderful thing being able to look at the thing that you're doing your science on and see it happen. So here it is. It starts out again, all with magnetization pointing down. And pretty soon we get two black walls. And pretty soon the walls move around. And then all the magnetization all points up. And so you see that there are then two different peaks. In fact, I set up the value e to the 2k in order to see these two different peaks. And what you're seeing is that the system, like a system like this, can have all of its magnetization point in one direction or in the opposite direction, and it can go from one to the other in this kind of dynamics. It isn't stuck anyplace. And we'll finish it up by clicking along and seeing the walls move around. Walls move around, and we've come to the end, I think. Okay, so let's go on and do analytics again. So I say turn off, and I think I don't have to do anything else. And then at some moment when the gods are with us, this will disappear into the ceiling, and the lights will go on. Now we are going to spend a little more time on this one-dimensional model because there's a little more to be learned from it. I'll talk only about the partition function, or mostly about the partition function, because the partition function has in it essentially all of the physics that we want to talk about, and we have a sum over sigma 1 up to sigma n. E to the k, sigma 1, sigma 2. I've written this a lot of times. E to the k, sigma 2, sigma 3. E to the k, sigma n, back to sigma 1. Let me think about this in the following way. Sum over sigma 1 up to sigma n. I will just introduce a fancy notation for this. I will call this exponential sigma 1 t sigma 2. That is, I'm thinking that there's some matrix called t, and this e to the k sigma 1 sigma 2 is the matrix element of t between the two states sigma 1 is equal to plus 1, or sigma 1 equals minus 1, and sigma 2 having the same plus 1 and minus 1. I hope you'll agree I have done nothing but define some notation. And if I write the next guy on as sigma 2 times t times sigma 3, I've continued to do nothing, just continue to do the same thing. Down to sigma n t sigma 1. What is this? Well, we have a matrix, sigma 1 t sigma 2, sigma 2 t sigma 3, and we're summing over sigma 2. This is just matrix multiplication. So if this is a matrix t, this summation is the sigma 1 sigma 3 element of t squared. And this whole blessed thing is the sum over sigma 1 of sigma 1 times t raised to the nth power times sigma 1. Nothing happened, just matrix multiplication. And this diagonal sum is called a trace. So we could write a matrix T, which represents this nearest neighbor interaction. And when we write that matrix to represent the nearest neighbor interaction, we calculate the partition function as the trace of T raised to the nth power. T is a matrix, 2x2 matrix. When the spins are the same, when sigma 1 is equal to sigma 2, that's when on the diagonal, we get e to the k. When sigma 1 is opposite from sigma 2, that's off the diagonal, we get e to the minus k. That's what the matrix is. Well, contemplate this. We have started out with a problem in one-dimensional statistical mechanics. We ended up with a problem in which we're calculating the trace of a matrix raised to a large power. That matrix raised to a large power will give us, in general, the largest eigenvalue of that matrix raised to that power. And so we have gone from a problem in statistical mechanics to a problem in eigenvalues, a problem which has the structure of quantum mechanics. In fact, you know this kind of thing, many of you, not all of you, many of you know this kind of thing in another disguise. This is Feynman's path integral formulation of quantum mechanics. And indeed, quantum mechanics and statistical mechanics are about equal to the same thing. In any case, I'm going to calculate the partition function by using this. The partition function, if this matrix is T and has eigenvalues T prime and T double prime, the partition function is T prime raised to the nth power plus T double prime raised to the nth power, because that's what the trace of t to the nth power is. It's the sum of the eigenvalues of the matrix raised to the nth power. And you may remember that we had a funny structure for the partition function. When we calculated what it was, we found it was twice the hyperbolic cosine of k raised to the nth power plus twice the hyperbolic sine of k raised to the nth power. And that's just exactly this structure. Now, my next job will be to calculate the eigenvalues of this matrix. I should not be surprised to discover that one eigenvalue is twice the hyperbolic cosine and the other is twice the hyperbolic sine. Going from here to here is some fancy footwork. It is not at all obvious that you can do this. In fact, the more general thing which you can do is that you can take a problem in d-dimensional stat mech and turn it into d minus one dimension quantum theory. So four-dimensional statistical mechanics is our world of three-dimensional particle physics. Do something on a big lattice in four dimensions in stat mech, and you're solving a field theory problem in three dimensions. This is the simplest example of that, but now I want to finish out by calculating what the trace of T is. In order to calculate the eigenvalues of any matrix, for example, this one, you subtract on the diagonal a number, lambda times unity, and you set the determinant equal to zero. That the solutions then, the lambdas that make this determinant equal to zero, are the eigenvalues of the matrix. This determinant then is e to the k minus lambda squared minus e to the minus 2k. And that has the solution. I'm going to write it up here so I don't. Lambda is e to the k plus or minus e to the minus k. Plus sign is e to the k plus e to the minus k. That's twice the hyperbolic cosine. Minus sign is e to the k minus e to the minus k. That's twice the hyperbolic sine. We come up with the same answer by these two different techniques. All kinds of one-dimensional problems can then be reduced to problems in simple matrix mechanics. But we're not done yet. I want to show you how to do renormalization calculations by using this one example of the one-dimensional Isaac model. So I'm going to change gears again. You all let me change gears? Here's a thing.
Between d-dimensional statistical mechanics and d minus one dimensional quantum theory. Like, are we assuming that we have d minus one space and one time, or just...
Let me say it in a different way, which makes it clearer. Many of you know what a Wick rotation is. That's a replacement of time by I times time, the square root of minus one times time. You make a Wick rotation on a problem in field theory. That is a problem in Minkowski space. And it's, you have a problem in Euclidean space. The problem in Euclidean space is essentially exactly a statistical mechanics problem. So four-dimensional statistical mechanics is four-dimensional Euclidean space is equal to three dimensions of space plus one of time, with a little bit of Wick rotation in order to get you into the right frame. In this one-dimensional case, I have a problem in zero spatial dimensions. And if I were talking about this thing as T is e to the Hamiltonian. I use terrible notation ham for Hamiltonian because I've used Hamiltonians all over the place for other things. This then gives me time dependence. N is essentially a time variable, the n from here. And yes, this is now a problem in zero dimensions of space and one dimension of time. So what has happened in the world at various times is that there are condensed matter people here and people who do field theory particle physics here. And every once in a while, they exchange ideas, come together, say that they're very working on the same problem maybe, except for maybe a Wick rotation, and then they separate, going off to do their own separate things. It is not trivial to say that you do a Wick rotation. Time and I times time are different. On the other hand, you can often generate answers by using tricks like Wick rotation. I'm going in an entirely different direction now. I'm going to show you how to do renormalization calculations using this one-dimensional Ising model. If you think I spend all my time putting dots and other things lined up on the blackboard, well, yes, it's true. So I have variables that I call sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3, sigma 4, sigma 5. I don't think I'll use sigma 6, but there it is. And I have, as you have seen now a zillion and a half times, a partition function, which is e to the k sigma 1, sigma 2, e to the k sigma 2, sigma 3, e to the k sigma 3, sigma 4, e to the k sigma 4, sigma 5. Ising spent a couple of years of his life learning how to do the summations, which give the answer of twice the hyperbolic cosine to the n plus twice the hyperbolic sine to the n. However, this involves a trick, a piece of being clever. There's another way you can approach this problem in a sort of more systematic way. That systematic way is to do some of the, to do some of the sums and leave the others to be done later. So you do some fraction of the work at any given time. I'm going to imagine summing over all of the even variables here. I want to come back to a problem that looks the same, so I will rename these variables with names that give them numbers that are lined up. So I'll call sigma 3 mu 2, sigma 5 mu 3, and so forth. But the basic process is one of summing this kind of thing over sigma 2. That's a trivial operation. We say e to the w. That's a interaction between sigma 1 and sigma 3 is the sum over sigma 2, e to the k sigma 1 sigma 2 plus k sigma 2 sigma 3. And I will furthermore call these variables by their new name. I'm just rewriting this as w of mu 1, mu 2. Now, this is an interaction term between the nearest neighbors. Is the sum over sigma 2 is plus or minus 1, e to the k, mu 1, sigma 2, plus sigma 2, mu 2. And this is some constant, it's going to turn out to be some constant, times e to the some new coupling k prime, times mu1 times mu2. Of course, that's the only thing it can turn out to be, because you only have two different possibilities. Either mu1 is equal to mu2, or mu1 is equal to minus mu2. And those are really the only two possibilities for different results. So some constant times e to the k prime, new coupling constant, times mu1, mu2 is going to be equal to this sum. The conceptualization is that we have a new coupling, k prime, representing the old problem seen on a different length scale. For example, the old problem had a lattice constant, that is the separation between nearest neighbors, A. In the new problem, we have A prime, which is twice A. A. A prime twice A. All of this is just filibuster because there's a little work to do to calculate this sum, and I'm trying to say the words before I get down to the work. There are two cases, one in which mu1 is equal to mu2, and the other is mu1 is equal to minus mu2. If mu1 is equal to mu2, this summation has two terms in it. There's an e to the 2k plus an e to the minus 2k. Those are the two terms in the summation. If mu1 is equal to minus mu2, this is unity, and the summation has two terms in it and comes out twice. The ratio of this is e to the 2k prime, since that's the ratio of the new coupling when the spins are lined up to the new coupling when the spins are anti-aligned. So e to the 2 new coupling is equal to e to the 2k plus e to the minus 2k over 2. And this is the hyperbolic cosine of k. So the new coupling is 1/2 the logarithm of the hyperbolic cosine of k. No, taking it backwards. Glasses. Let's see whether I left something out. Nope. New coupling as a function of the old coupling, 1/2 the logarithm of the hyperbolic cosine of 2k. We now know how to do expansions. For example, if I'm going to look, and it's interesting to look at the case going k going to infinity. The new coupling is 1/2 times the logarithm of e to the 2k divided by 2. I have left out the e to the minus 2k term because it's much smaller, which is just writing k minus log 2 over 2. K going to 0, k prime is the logarithm of the hyperbolic cosine of 2k. For small k, that is 1 plus 2 times k squared, logarithm gives 2 times k squared. K prime is 2k squared for small k. So what's going on? We are looking at the old problem in a different way. Some things are going to be quite unchanged when we look at the old problem in a different way. In particular, the range of correlations, which is A over the logarithm of the hyperbolic tangent of k to the minus 1. This correlation length is going to have the property that the correlation length in the new problem, it's the same physics, the same physical decay. In fact, we've just changed the names of the variables. This is mu and this is mu. Before it was named sigma, but it's the same problem. We expect to have exactly the same value of the range of correlations, except now it's written as the logarithm of the hyperbolic tangent of k prime, the new coupling, to the minus 1. And if you work out what this thing is, well, a prime is 2a, and this thing is twice that thing, and the 2's cancel out, and c prime is equal to c. It's not exactly the world's most obvious calculation. Working with hyperbolic cosines is simple, but not for grade school kids. It's a little bit tricky algebra. OK, but now we want to see it. We want to see it. And let me tell you what we're going to be seeing, because it's sort of interesting. I'm thinking about a problem, or essentially about problems with coupling k. And I'm going to start out with a problem here. Maybe this is k is 3. And then I'm going to be doing a renormalization. That is, I'm going to be changing a to twice a. I'm going to be summing over half of the variables. And I will come up with a new problem. In fact, you can see what is going to come up. You're going to get k prime is k minus log 2 over 2. Or so you're going to get k prime is equal to 2.65. This is one renormalization. We do another renormalization, and we get a smaller k, and another renormalization, and we get a smaller k yet. And as we continue to do renormalizations, we sum more and more of the variables in the theory. We get, and we move in this direction on the axis of k. What we're saying is that if we look at a large enough length scale at any one-dimensional problem, all one-dimensional problems look like weak coupling. This is, in fact, the reason that Lenz and Ising got disappointed in their calculation. One-dimensional problems always behave like weak coupling problems. They never have a behavior which looks like stronger coupling. They never have a phase transition. I'm trying to figure out whether I want to actually show you the numerics of the renormalization scheme. I think I will show you the numerics. The screen, you have a question, yes?
In our simulation, your simulation, we had the phase transition done by Jones.
Well, no, we didn't. That is, okay, you get. Okay, now we've got a good story to tell. If we look in some fancy magazine, we see an advertisement that says the diamonds are forever. What that means is that if you have a crystal of this material, that crystal stays essentially as long as you can imagine. In fact, longer, lots longer than you can imagine. It's not the only possible way you can arrange carbon. You could arrange carbon like in graphene, which is thin sheets, or you can arrange it in carbon black, which is an amorphous form of carbon, or in several other forms of carbon. But once you get it into one of those forms, it is stable, not for a day, not for a week, but for a very, very long period of time. It has to be so, because the microscopic time constant for motion of the motion of the atoms in molecules, in atoms in carbon, is about 10 to the minus 13 seconds. So if you wait a year, you have waited 10 to the 20th times the time constant of the material, and it shows no signs of turning into carbon black. If it does, you've been in the wrong jewelry store. In 2 and 3 and 4 and higher dimensions, you have permanent materials, permanently in phases. In fact, in the limit of n going to infinity, they are absolutely permanent in the phases they have. That is, a tiny diamond can actually do bad things. But that has to be really tiny, microscopically tiny. But a substantial hunk of diamond or quartz will stay in that crystal structure sort of forever. N goes infinity, there are different phases. In d equals 2 or 3. It is much less true in d equals 1. In fact, it is quite untrue in d equals 1. What happens in d equals 1, bless me, I'm putting dots on the paper again. What happens in d equals 1 is that you get these block walls. They are thermodynamic in the sense that if you have a big enough system, you're going to have block walls. In fact, you'll have a block wall put in once in every coherence length. That's what the coherence length is about. So you'll have in that length a block wall. So the system will contain lots of block walls. And they'll be continually moving around. They can move from one end of the system to another relatively easily. And since they have 10 to the 20th time constants to do it in, they will do it. One-dimensional systems do not form permanent phases. It turns out that in order to make the analog of a block wall in 2 or 3 dimensions, it costs an infinite, energy proportional to the size of the length of the system. That is exponentially unlikely proportional to the length of the system. In the limit of large n, we get absolutely permanent phases. So what you saw when you saw the thing go from magnetized this way to magnetized that way was not a real phase change. It is a simple instability in the one-dimensional system. One-dimensional systems have no phases. They have instabilities. I'm going to make a tiny little speech before I'll answer your question. You may notice that I made an argument which is crucially dependent on n goes to infinity. You don't have a distinction between carbon black and diamond, except in large hunks of matter. You don't have a distinction between solid water and liquid water unless you have a reasonably large amount of water to look at. That reasonably a large amount involves large numbers n, and we are making arguments about the nature of many body systems by thinking about what happens for large n. That's the characteristic of what we do in 20th century, 21st century physics, that we think about limiting processes like n goes to infinity and try to ask what physics arises in that. Got a question there. Yep.
It'd be like a circle, like a small circle that's independent of the size of the symbol on a two-dimensional plane.
For once, I think I don't understand the question, but let me describe something that happens in. Okay, I construct this is real. I construct a cable of superconducting material. So here it is, this cable. It's not such a fat cable, it's a pretty thin cable. And what it can do is it can, at the cost proportional to the radius of the cable, the cost and probability, it can shove magnetic field across the cable. It can shove magnetic flux across the cable. In order to have a true superconductor, which is in a superconducting phase and will allow currents to flow forever, we have to have a pretty thick cable. That pretty thick cable means that in order to see flux moving across the cable, you have to wait longer than the age of the universe. And so the pretty thick cable is better than a pretty good conductor. I'm not sure that I answered your question, but the part of the question has to do with what I called a topological defect. Many of these things, like the flux quantum moving through the superconductor or the black wall, has a combination of the geometry of space and the geometry of the phase. A spin goes that way and that way, and a black wall in an Ising model has to do with the connection between space and this flipping. A superconducting cable has a phase in a different sense, an e to the I theta in it, describing its the wave function that it has. And it too has topological defects, which have something to do with the organization of that e to the I theta type phase. Wave function, that's why you get an e to the I theta. So at this point, we are bumping into respectably deep questions in the nature of physics. I keep thinking about the beginning of Tolstoy's book, Anna Karenina, in which he says that all happy families are alike. Well, all small systems are sort of alike, but big systems can be different from one another. Big systems can be diamonds or graphite, whereas if you get five carbon molecules, they're five carbon molecules, and they will rearrange themselves in any way they want. Yep? Didn't understand the question.
Big systems are sad, then? Are they sad? Because they are not similar? Like,
I wasn't going to do unhappy. It depends on what you like. I like excitement at home. So if... to a limited degree now, not too much of it. We can't follow Tolstoy too far. The world is not a novel, and our systems are not Anna Karenina. But it is another way of saying what I started the course with, that more is different, that is big systems are different from small systems and have a different kind of behavior. There was another question. Yes?
On the right, at the top, each of the 2k prime equals?
Yeah.
Where did you get the that?
I did it quick, but some constant times e to the k prime times the product of the mu's. This defines what the new k prime is the sum of the over the old sigmas of the old sigma of e to the k sigma 2 times sigma 2 mu 3. It's actually mu 2, but that's neither here nor there. So if mu 1 is equal to mu 2, I get this summation is e to the 2k plus e to the minus 2k. If the mu's are different, you always have a zero up in the exponent, and you get 2. The ratio of e to the k prime, I want to get rid of this constant. That's what I'm doing. I take the ratio of this term for mu 1 equals mu 2 to the term with mu 1 equals minus mu 2. That's e to the 2k prime. That's right there. That ratio is e to the 2k prime, and then it's the ratio of that to that, and I'm done. Let me see where I am. I wanted to spend a second telling you about the homework, because there are a couple of things on the homework which are not exactly obvious. In designing the homework, I used the phrase IID. That's statistics jargon for independently and identically distributed. That is, the sigmas that we use throughout this calculation are independent of one another, statistically independent, and they're identical to one another in their properties. They are example of IDD system. And I use this particular piece of jargon in the homework. In the homework, I also ask you to calculate the pressure for a system in which we have a bunch of particles. With a interaction between them, V of Rj minus Rk, summed over J less than K. There are several ways in which you calculate the pressure. I suggest you do it by calculating the partition function and using thermodynamics, because you can get the first order correction in weak coupling by doing that rather easily, and it's hard other ways. So I suggest you go after the pressure by going after the partition function and thinking what it means for that potential to be weak, so that you can calculate things to first order in the potential. It is a good time for me to switch topics. Let me introduce the next topic, which is just what you might think it is. It's the two-dimensional Isaac model. And what we're going to have for the next couple of times, before and after Thanksgiving, I think. Well, maybe we'll finish it up before Thanksgiving. It's a two-dimensional Ising model. See, I get to do something different. Instead of doing one row, I get to do lots of rows. So each one of these points represents a variable, which I might call sigma jk, labeled by two indices which give the spatial position, and the bonds that occur on this lattice, that is, these lines, represent couplings, e to the k times sigma prime, where sigma and sigma prime are nearest neighbors. This two-dimensional Ising model has a phase transition, as I will show you next time. You can guess that I have a Monte Carlo calculation, which shows you the more or less what happens in the two-dimensional Ising model. There are also much better Monte Carlo calculations that other people have carried out, and I'll show you pictures of that. I will then tell you something about the physics of this and tell you why the problem is interesting. It has, in fact, been solved, and that in just before the Second World War, Cramers and Vanier used an argument called the duality argument to find the critical coupling strength of the two-dimensional Ising model. Their duality argument is somewhat similar to duality arguments that are presently being used in string theory and particle physics in order to understand the relation between different models. Then, during and just after the Second World War, Lars Ansager, in a brilliant feat, calculated in an exact fashion the partition function of the two-dimensional Ising model. Later, people used his calculation in order to get insights into what happens near a phase transition, insights into what a phase transition might be. So I will start talking about that next time, and we will go to two dimensions. I think we're done with one dimension. We'll go to two dimensions. We will try to talk about what is the physics in two dimensions. And then I believe I will go on to talking about dynamics, tell you what happens in the dynamics of Hamiltonian systems and why Hamiltonian systems approach equilibrium. That will be for after Thanksgiving. So the Ising model before Thanksgiving, two-dimensional Ising model.